Well, thank you all for coming this evening. Really been a delight finally seeing the center that you've all created here. I've heard about it from Charles and Patricia for quite a while. So it's nice to be part of the activity here. Usually in these evening presentations, I would normally prepare a Dharma talk and give a more formal talk. But tonight I didn't prepare anything. And I thought just to speak about a few basic principles or concepts, ideas of the Buddhist teachings and perhaps how they relate to one another. We'll see if it all flows or not. And then there'll be time, you know, if you have any questions or time for discussion afterwards. I think one of the most important foundational understandings of the Buddha's teachings has to do with what he referred to as the law or the truth of karma, which means that our actions, whether the actions are of our body or our speech or our mind, bring results. Now, these teachings on karma can get very complicated, and there are lots of philosophic discussion about how it all plays out and what it means. But I think for us, we can understand it in a very immediate and practical way. And that is understanding that what we do, how we act, the way we speak, has an effect not only on other people, but on our own minds. So we are creating, moment to moment, our own inner mental environment. And this is the environment we inhabit in our lives. When we understand this, we begin to take more responsibility for our actions, for our speech, for our thoughts, what we choose to give energy to, what we choose to let go of, because we realize that our own happiness depends on this awareness. You're probably familiar with this Vietnamese Zen master, mindfulness master, Thich Nhat Hanh. He had a wonderful expression. He said, "Buddhism is a clever way to enjoy life. Happiness is available. Please help yourselves to it." Happiness is available, and we can help ourselves to it if we are mindful about what we're doing, if we're mindful of the kinds of thoughts that are arising in our minds, if we're mindful of our speech, if we're mindful of our actions. And the Buddha made it quite simple, actually, in terms of us understanding what leads to happiness and what leads to suffering. And you're probably familiar, he talked of how the three wholesome roots of mind, the three wholesome roots of all those actions that bring happiness are non-greed or generosity, non-hatred or love, and non-delusion or wisdom. And the three roots of action that bring suffering are exactly the opposite. They're the actions of greed, of hatred, of delusion. And so our task is to pay close enough attention so that we realize what it is that we're doing, which qualities of mind are we actually cultivating. The point of reference for discerning whether something is skillful or unskillful is quite subtle. The point of reference is the motivation behind the action. And it's said in some teachings that everything rests on the tip of motivation. That's how important this quality is. So before we speak, what's our motive What's our motivation for speaking? You know, before we act, or in our thoughts, what's the motivation? This can be very subtle because very often we have mixed motivations. You know, an action can be quite either complex or hidden, and we may not at first really know what our motivation is. So it takes a willingness, it takes an interest, and sometimes it takes courage, a kind of a real honesty to see, okay, what is really going on here? If we are engaged in an act of generosity, is it coming from a very pure place, you know, of giving, of love, of compassion? Is it mixed in with the motive, perhaps, of wanting approval, or wanting love, or thinking, oh, if I'm generous, this is going to be a good karmic result, and I'm going to get a lot back? So there can be a lot of different motivations in a very simple act. We shouldn't be discouraged by this. This is just how it is for most of us. I think the important challenge is to be willing to look and to be honest about what's there, and then to emphasize the wholesome aspect. There may be the other aspects, they may be there, but we can emphasize or give precedence to really that motive that's most pure. I'll just share with you a slightly embarrassing story from the earliest years of my teaching. I was still in India. I wasn't really quite a teacher. But in the summer months, we'd go up to the mountains. It was very hot in the plains, and there would be a group of Dharma friends. And Munindraji, my first Dharma teacher, he just encouraged me to give a little Dharma talk, you know, once a week, just to the group of friends who were there. And so once a week, we would all meet, and the motive was pretty much pure. You know, but I was in love with the Dharma, and I just wanted to share. But I noticed myself every week counting how many people came. Oh, this week 10 people came. Next week, you know, 12. And it was just so interesting. I was just watching my mind do this. I wasn't asking for it to do it. It just seemed to do it by itself. So I didn't worry about the fact that my mind was doing it, and I didn't have self-judgment or self-blame, but I could be aware of it. I said, oh yeah, there's that part of the mind that's looking for, I don't know, whatever it was looking for. And then I could just get into, you know, giving a little Dharma talk and sharing, and it was all fine. And then the motive got purified in the very act of speaking the Dharma. So it was just an early little lesson in how often our motives can be mixed, and that it's okay. The important thing is that we don't delude ourselves. The important thing is just that we're honest. We see, okay, this part is here, this part is here. And then we act from the wholesome part as best we can. What's so amazing about Dharma practice and the teachings is that as we do cultivate the more wholesome aspects, our minds actually get happier. They get lighter. So one example of this, which I know you're all familiar with, is when we cultivate the Brahmaviharas, you know, the feelings of love and compassion, and empathetic joy and equanimity. The feeling of metta, the feeling of loving kindness, bring such a quality of lightness and friendliness, right, to our way of relating to people. There's one little problem, I think, that can arise, at least in the English translation of metta, of loving-kindness. And I've seen this come up over the years. You know, we speak of loving-kindness, and sometimes people emphasize the love aspect. And I don't know how it is in French, but the word in English, it's like, even though it's just four letters, it's a huge word, you know, love and what it means. And we have so much projection and ideas and fantasies about what love means. And very often people feel, oh, well, I'm not loving enough, or all kinds of conditioning around it. And so sometimes this might be a hindrance or an obstacle for actually practicing it. Right, because we're not even quite sure exactly what it is in its pure form. I find that for myself, I really like to emphasize the kindness aspect of metta. Because kindness, that feels like a very down-to-earth quality. You know, it's very pragmatic. It's not kind of up there in some abstract way. It's just as we're with people, as we relate to people, can we practice being kind? You know, kind in our speech, kind in our actions. So it feels very pragmatic to me. It feels something, yeah, this is something I can do. I might not be able to love everybody with the, you know, that great expanse of meaning, but I can practice just being kind. So we each need to find for ourselves the way of practice that will actually strengthen this quality of friendliness. One aspect of metta, of this kindness, it talks about, you know, what are the causes for it to arise. And this itself is a very interesting teaching. And it can often bring up a lot of questions in the mind. It says that the cause for metta to arise is seeing the goodness in people, to see what is good in people. Because when we see or focus on what is good in people, naturally we have a friendly feeling. But some people hear that or understand it, and they may understand it as being a little false, you know, or a little sentimental. Oh, we're just supposed to always see the good in people, and it can be a little sweet. But there's a way of practicing that specific teaching that is really very profound. And that is, it's not that we kind of blind ourselves to seeing the totality of a person. Right? When we're with people, we can see whatever we see. You know, and sometimes there's the good qualities and sometimes there's the not so good qualities. But what the Buddha is saying here is, even as we're seeing the totality of the person and understanding it, can we focus our attention on that part of them that is good? And when we do, what we find is that our minds become much less judgmental. It's not that we don't see, it's not that we're pretending, oh, everybody's, you know, wonderful all the time, because very few people are. So we see it all, but we're focusing, we're giving emphasis, we're valuing what's good in people. And that generates a very natural and spontaneous feeling of friendliness. So these are just ways of practicing, of putting into practice the understanding that what we cultivate in our minds will affect not only the other person, but will affect our own happiness. we're a lot happier when we're less judgmental. The Dalai Lama had some beautiful words about this. He said, and this itself is a great practice, he said he tries to be with every person he meets as an old friend. Now that's wonderful. Can you imagine just everybody you meet, the people you know well and the people you don't know well, but to meet them and to treat them as if they're an old friend. And for those of you who may have had the opportunity to meet His Holiness, it's just what it's like. When you're with Him, His attention is so complete and full and focused on you, feel like His old friend, you know, and it's a wonderful feeling. So we may not yet have quite His capacity for doing it, but it's a practice, you know, if we remember, yeah, this would be something to cultivate in our lives. Okay, so this is just kind of a few reflections on understanding how we can apply the teachings of karma, meaning that our actions of our body, of our speech, of our mind, have impact. They have impact on the people around us. Most importantly, they have impact on our own minds. So we can take responsibility. One important lesson in meditation, not only in meditation, just one important lesson we can learn from life, although we often don't learn it, is that nobody makes us feel a certain way. How we feel about anything that happens, how we feel is up to us. People may do difficult, harmful things, you know, and it may cause all kinds of disturbance in our life, but how we're relating to that, that's really up to us. And I had one example of this years ago. I was, this goes back quite a few years, I was in this relationship and we were having a little argument, and in the course of the argument, my friend turns to me and she says, "Stop making me feel aversion." And I started to laugh, which was not a good move. So I learned that. But it was a striking reminder of how often we put the responsibility for how we feel on other people. Right? And somehow if they were different, I wouldn't feel the way I do. That's very disempowering. You know, when we realize that how we feel, that's up to us, that's up to our own mental cultivation, our own understanding. And the Buddha gave a very powerful teaching about this, and it's one that I love the teaching because it's such a high standard that it really emphasizes the potential for us. So he was talking about, this was in the context of right speech, but it was really about right listening. And in one sutta, the Buddha's talking to a group of monks, or it might have been a group of lay people, I'm not sure. And he says, people may speak to you in different ways. They may speak to you truthfully or untruthfully. They may speak to you gently or harshly. They may speak to you with a heart of loving kindness, or they may speak to you with a heart filled with hatred. And he goes on, so it just goes on this long list. And then he says, regardless of how people speak to you, you should abide with a heart of loving kindness, compassionate for their welfare. Well, that's something. You know, just imagine somebody speaking to, they're lying to you. They want to do you harm, and they're speaking in a very angry fashion. So just imagine what that would be like. And here's the Buddha saying, regardless of how they're speaking to you, you should abide with a heart of loving kindness, concern for their welfare, compassion. Now that's a practice. Right? And this ties in, this practice ties in beautifully to the teachings in the Satipatthana Discourse, you know, the Discourse on the Foundations of Mindfulness, where repeatedly through the discourse, the Buddha talks about being mindful internally, externally, and both. Right? So normally we know, okay, what mindfulness internally means, we're aware of our own processes, but this teaching is really an example of being mindful externally. So it's like, here's this person speaking in this very unwholesome way. The choice is, are we simply reacting to all that and maybe getting angry ourselves or defensive or hurt or whatever it may be, or can we practice being mindful externally, just recognizing this person is speaking harshly, this person is speaking what is not true. So we're seeing it, we're not pretending that it's not happening, but we're in a place of balance. We're in a place of simply being mindful that this is happening. And from that mindfulness, there's the possibility of resting in a place of loving kindness, concern for their welfare. Right? Knowing, understanding that they're creating tremendous suffering for themselves in that kind of speech. But did this make sense to you? A powerful teaching. This is not something that's easy to do. But when I read that, I thought this would really be a challenge, an interesting challenge to bring to difficult conversations. Right, where we can stay centered with a genuine compassion. Okay, so this is a lot about understanding karma as creating our own inner mental environment. You know, whether it's an environment of peace, of happiness, of kindness, or not. Are we creating an environment of anger, hatred, ill will, judgment, and realizing that it's totally up to us. No one makes us feel a certain way. So this is one little piece. A second little piece. These are like little Dharma vignettes. One other component of the teachings, which is basic, I mean, this is incredibly essential. And I'll just tell a little story about it. Are you familiar with Suzuki Roshi? He wrote the book Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, and he founded the San Francisco Zen Center many years ago. And he died some time ago. But somebody once asked him a question. They commented, they said, Roshi, I have been listening to your talks for many years. I still don't understand anything. Can you please express the Dharma? Do you know the expression in a nutshell? You know, just the very essence. Can you just please explain the Dharma very simply so I can understand it? And Suzuki Roshi said just two words. He said, everything changes. If we could really understand those two words, we would understand the whole Dharma. This truth of impermanence has so many profound implications. Many times in the suttas, in the discourses, we read the statement where the Buddha would say, whatever has the nature to arise will also pass away. And many times people would hear just that phrase and get enlightened. So I'm going to say it once more. So this is your chance. Whatever has the nature to arise will also pass away. What has the nature to arise? Everything. Now, what's interesting about this is that on a conceptual level, we all know this. This is not a mysterious teaching. And you could go up to anybody on the streets of Geneva and say, do things change? Everybody would say yes. Right? So this is not a mystery. But we know it intellectually, deeply, but we don't really live from that understanding. Because if we really lived from that understanding, we would not cling to anything. We would not grasp at things. What happens when we cling to something which in its very nature will change? The more we cling, the more we suffer. It's so obvious. You know, if we cling to youth, how do we feel as we get older? If we cling to health, how do we feel when we get sick? It doesn't mean that we shouldn't take care of our health, but like everything else, these conditions change. So the body is going to get older, the body is going to get sick, the body is going to die. The more we cling to that which changes, the more we suffer. And so our practice is somehow, it's somehow learning to actually be perceiving the change, not simply knowing that things change. The real transformation of our minds and the deepening of wisdom is when we are seeing the changing nature directly in our experience, which is a lot of what the meditation practice is about. You know, in the beginning we start, it's first it's just like just calming the mind in some way, collecting the attention, getting a little grounded, a little peaceful. But the real beginning of Vipassana, the real beginning of insight meditation, is when we start seeing how things are arising and passing moment after moment. And we can see this on many levels. There's something which I call NPMs, which are noticings per minute. Now, at first, our NPMs are pretty low. You know, maybe we have, I don't know, 5 NPMs or 10 NPMs. You know, we may notice 5 or 10 different things in a minute. But as our practice deepens and as our mindfulness gets stronger and we're really attending to things very carefully, the NPMs go way up and we can begin to distinguish things arising and passing so quickly. And we really are seeing the momentariness of phenomena. So even just as something simple as hearing the sound, go to just a person on the street, what did you hear? Oh, I heard the sound of the bell. But for a meditator, you know, how many different vibrations and nuances and just hundreds, thousands of things are going on. Which if we're attentive, if we're really paying attention, we can hear that, we can know that. The same thing with the breath. We might think that the breath, oh, take an in-breath, take an out-breath, two things, two notings. Within each breath, how many different sensations are there? You know, within each out-breath, or in a step. It's not just one thing. There are many, many things happening. So the more carefully we pay attention, our mind begins to open to the rapidity of change, of phenomena. And our sense of ourselves becomes much less solid, much less fixed. Right? Most of us have a pretty fixed idea, concept, you know, of who we are. It's like, there's the story of, you know, somebody getting up in the morning, looking in the mirror, yep, that's me. Because we recognize the image and, yeah, that's me. This is who I am. But when we are observing this mind-body process, particularly in meditation, when our minds are quite focused, but throughout the day, when we're observing carefully, we see so many arisings and passings of sensations and thoughts and emotions and sounds and sights, and there is so much going on. And so this illusion of solidity begins to break up a little bit. And this leads into the third aspect of the teachings. It's from our increasingly refined perception of change. Not thinking about it, but perceiving it. When we're actually perceiving change on a finer and finer level, that becomes the doorway to understanding what is perhaps the most difficult aspect of the Buddha's teachings, which is the teaching on selflessness. You know, whereas impermanence, that's not hard to understand, even if we don't see it that clearly all the time. The truth of suffering, not so hard to understand. You know, we all have experience of that. But the teachings on selflessness, on anatta, that's hard. That's hard to understand. It doesn't fit with our common sense view of ourselves or the world. Right? So this really takes a lot more investigation to understand, okay, what is the Buddha talking about? This understanding of selflessness. I mean, this, as you know, could be the subject of many, many Dharma talks. So in 4 minutes... Just a few things to say about it, and again, maybe just these will just be seeds for further reflection. First, what's important to understand about this teaching is that in understanding selflessness, it's not that there is something there that we get rid of. What the Buddha is saying is that the notion of self from the very beginning is a concept, is an idea. And so in understanding selflessness, we're simply freeing ourselves from the prison of that particular concept. So one example which I've used for the past 40 years, but you're a new crowd. But I'm not sure of the terminology, so some of you will have to help me. In English, you know, we use the constellation we call the Big Dipper. Is that the same? Okay, so I'll say Big Dipper. Is that what it translates as? Yeah, good. Okay, so this is the question for you. Is there really a Big Dipper in the sky? There's no Big Dipper. What happens is we look at the sky, we see this very apparent constellation. It's very easy, you know, to pick out. So we put a name on it, Big Dipper, and that concept separates out those stars from all the other stars in the sky. the notion of self, the concept of self, of Joseph, is like Big Dipper. There's a pattern, there's the elements, all the elements of mind and body, you know, the material elements and thoughts and emotions and all these elements are like the stars of the constellation. They're in a certain pattern. And the pattern is consistent and we can recognize it. Oh yeah, this is Joseph. And it follows certain laws. But there's no thing in itself, just like there's no Big Dipper. There's no Joseph, there's no self apart from the pattern that's there. So a few follow-up questions. Next time the sky's clear, go out at night and see if it's possible not to see the Big Dipper. It's really difficult. You know, we have been so conditioned to see in a certain way, it's very hard not to see it. But if we can loosen, attachment is a bit too strong a word for Big Dipper, but if we can just loosen the conditioning a bit around seeing the Big Dipper, what happens? Then we see the entire sky, not separated out. So as we begin to just loosen a bit the conditioning around the concept of self, of Joseph, we still use it. You know, on the relative level, we still act and relate as individuals, as selves one to another. So on the relative level, all of that is the same. But if we understand on a deeper level that the self or Joseph is a concept, just like Big Dipper is a concept, then there's a lot more fluidity in our lives. We're no longer in a prison of self-image, of self-concept. And so there's a lot more creativity, a lot more ease. One of the very interesting things, just in using this image of Big Dipper, when we see that, or when we understand that there's really no Big Dipper, does anything change in the sky? Do those stars suddenly disappear? No. Everything is exactly the same. Everything is as it always was. We're simply not overlaying a concept onto those particular stars, but nothing changes. In the same way, sometimes people hear these teachings on selflessness and get a little afraid. No self. You know, am I going to just disappear in a puff of smoke or... Nothing changes. Everything is exactly as it always was, except that we're seeing it and understanding it more clearly. And in that clarity, there's less attachment to the notion of self, even though we still use it conventionally, but we're not so attached to it. And in being less attached to it, there's less clinging and less grasping at all of the changing phenomena that we're calling self. And the less clinging and grasping there is, the less we suffer. So happiness is available. Please help yourselves to it. Okay, I think this is... I can wrap all this up. So we just want to start with the understanding of karma, which means that the actions that we take in our body, in our speech, in our mind, and particularly the motivations, right, that are influencing the action, bring results. They are creating our mental environment. They're creating this inner world that we're inhabiting it. Inhabiting. What kind of world do we want to live in? It's totally up to us. So we understand that. We begin to appreciate how the doorway into a deeper understanding of the Dharma is through the direct perception of change, that things Everything has the nature to change. Everything that arises will pass away. The more we see that, the less we cling. The less we cling, we begin to see with greater clarity the selfless nature of this whole process. And this is the whole path of awakening, of waking up from delusion, waking up from ignorance. And we come to what the Buddha called the highest happiness, which is peace. And we really, in a gradual way, begin to experience this more and more in our lives.